Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Today our guest is Hugo Gurdon, editor-in-chief of the Washington Examiner, where he recently wrote an article about Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. He joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Hugo, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Hi, John. Thanks very much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. It's not the kind of thing that I normally do with to discuss fiction. But anyway, great to be with you.
So why is Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner a great book?
You know, John, I'm very stingy with the label great, and I sometimes find myself denying it to books, even by some of the greatest novels. So, for example, like, you know, George Eliot, I wouldn't say that Daniel Deronda was a great book, whereas Middlemarch is perhaps one of the greatest. The thing about this book, Angle of Repose, is it's a wonderful book. It's a beautifully written book. The prose style is marvelous. It has a sort of great clarity. But whether it achieves greatness or not, it has that one of those qualities of greatness, which is that you, once you've read it, you realize that you've actually been engaged with something important and something that made you think afresh. There are a number of different things apart from the prose style. It is a book in which there's enormous subtlety about whether or not what you're reading, that there is a narrator in it, and there's an enormous subtlety about whether or not he's telling you the facts or whether he's trying to kind of create a narrative which isn't quite true. And he's looking back from the 1960s, the late 1960s, to the 1870s. The basic story is he is a retired professor and he wants to write a book about his grandmother, Susan Burling Ward. His name is Lyman Ward. And you have this wonderful perspective of, you know, the beginning of the feminist and sexual revolution, or it was well underway by then, and looking back at America and particularly, well, the relationship between the East Coast and the West, but the development of America during a time that was both rip-roaring in its economic expansion and its ambition, but very sort of straight-laced and proper and contained in its social mores, and of course it's an extremely compelling tale. It's not just because it's enlightening about America and there's these interesting perspectives and it's well written. It's also a very it's a real compelling drama of different personalities. So it has several qualities that make it a wonderful book.
We'll talk about all of that, the story, the characters, the narrator, the reliability of the narrator, what this book says about America, what it says about America in the 1870s, what it says about America in the 1960s. But Hugo, let's start off with the very beginning of the book. The narrator announces the date and place of his story when he begins to tell it. It's April 12th, 1970. He's in Grass Valley, California. We learn quickly that he's in a dispute with his son. Who is this narrator and what's going on?
The narrator is a professor called Lyman Ward, and he is in a wheelchair. He has a terrible disease that is sort of, his body is essentially ossifying, and he has a son who he fears wants to institutionalize him, or, you know, take him away from the house in which he's lived for a long time, the old family house. He absolutely refuses to do that, and he is constantly trying to give the impression that he can cope better than he can with his disease, because he doesn't want to be cajoled and pushed into living life that he doesn't want. So he's there in the old family house, and he's fearful of his, I think, rather dreary, efficient son. Lyman Ward has been abandoned and deserted by his wife, so he's living by himself, but with the assistance of a housekeeper and ultimately her hippie daughter. And so Lyman Ward is this he's this elderly fellow who is able to look back at the, you know, he's just one lifetime away from his grandmother's life back in the 1870s, but there he is in the late 60s, early 70s, living in sort of what was then, of course, modern California, coping with the extraordinary revolution in sexual and cultural mores, and trying to write this book, which starts off as a biography, I suppose, a sort of history of his grandmother, Susan Burling Ward, who was a fictional character as well, you know, who was an illustrator and a sort of rather genteel but somewhat snobbish young woman at that time from the East Coast. But it ends up being really the story of her troubled marriage to her husband, Oliver Ward, who's an engineer to whom she moves out to the West, and where he's a mining engineer and an irrigation engineer. That's a sort of rather diverse answer to your question, but I hope it actually gets to it.
So Lyman Ward is our narrator. He wants to write about his grandmother, also his grandfather's grandparents, I suppose, but his grandmother, Susan Burling Ward, this frontier grandmother from the 19th century, she is his major interest, at least starting out. She begins life not in the West, but New York City. What happens to her?
Well, she is part of the sort of literary circle in New York, and she has a couple of particularly close friends there whom she admires, and I think she feels slightly inferior to. At a party in the East, she meets the man who becomes her husband, Oliver Ward. Pretty much nothing actually happens between them at this party. They talk, and then they strike up a relationship in which they simply correspond with each other by letter. But somehow, over the course of that correspondence, it becomes tacitly understood that they are engaged. And there is certainly a sense that Susan Burling Ward allows this to happen, or because she is disappointed in what she thinks might be a burgeoning romance in the East, and the man that the literary gentleman who she thinks is taking an interest in her, then in fact proposes and marries her best friend. So to use the sort of rather vulgar modern term, there's some sense that she marries or becomes engaged to Oliver Ward on the rebound.
It's a kind of marriage of convenience, though, and she probably hopes that she'll fall in love with him eventually.
Well, it's convenient to her in that it allows her to be an engaged young woman, but it's an enormously inconvenient marriage to her in that it takes her away from her milieu, where she's an illustrator, probably in the sort of Hudson School type of illustration, lovely pictures of parkland and the Hudson Valley and the East, and it takes her out of that and takes her to the rip-roaring West, where the territories are not even states, and there is just a sort of explosive economic activity as Americans and, in fact, people from all over the world, Chinese as well, Mexicans, are there developing and, in, you might say, plundering the West for its resources and trying to tame it and bring it into the United States.
Oliver Ward's a mining engineer, so of course his work has to take him out West. He transplants Susan, brings her into this alien world, alien to her. How would you describe his career? It's transient. He moves around a lot. What happens to them?
Well, they move from one place to another. They start off in a town called New Almaden, where he is a mining engineer, and he is an intelligent, somewhat gentlemanly fellow, certainly a civilized fellow, but he's socially awkward, and he's not good at speaking up for himself. He's not quite he isn't as adept as his wife. She believes that he is mistreated by the manager, and so he never gets the credit for his successes. They stay there for a while, and they have a son, also named Oliver. But they move from there to Leadville in Colorado, where it's very much a frontier mining town, very tough town where murder and lynching are not uncommon. And another point, they go off to Mexico, and then they go to Idaho. So they traipse around the West doing various jobs, and his is a faltering career. He's smart, he's well-educated, but he never quite shapes up. And ultimately, he doesn't express jealousy exactly, but in Leadville, his deputy is a handsome young man called Frank Sargent, and Frank Sargent falls profoundly in love with Susan Ward, and she reciprocates. And this is one of the central tensions of the book, that, you know, this being the 1870s and the fact that Frank Sargent is actually wants to be a loyal and a deputy to Oliver Ward and is indeed admires him. You know, there's a few exchanges of looks between Susan and Frank, and one or two secretive clinches which cause enormous embarrassment and sense of guilt. So it's the story of a couple, Oliver and Susan, who move around the West from job to job, him sort of failing as he goes along and eventually turning to drink, and she probably yearning for this younger man, Frank Sargent, and he being, I think it's described as his incurable disease is to love her. So that's the central to the story from the 1870s.
So then how is this story more than just a love triangle between these three people?
It's more than that, because you don't know how much of what Lyman Ward as narrator and historian is telling you is true. There's this wonderful interplay of his determination to try and portray things accurately and be tough-minded, but at the same time he's writing about his grandmother and his grandfather. You often get the impression that he doesn't want to face the truth. And so there's this great refraction of the facts through his familial interests and his fondness for the memory of his grandparents. And so you're reading a story by a man who cannot possibly know the precise discussions that took place between these three people in the love triangle. And what you're actually reading about as you read the story from the 1870s is you're also reading about the prejudices and the concerns, the mores and the familial difficulties of the narrator, Lyman Ward. And one of the things that is always present is the fact that Lyman Ward has been betrayed by his wife and is bitter about that. And he's writing about his grandmother, and one isn't quite sure of the extent or the limitations of her betrayal of her husband, the narrator's grandfather. So it's very subtle, and it's both revealing and hidden. And you know, and then you get to the subject, as you were mentioned, of the unreliable narrator. And I would say that this book by Wallace Stegner is as good at capturing the idea of an unreliable narrator, so you don't quite know what's going on, as, for example, Kazuo Ishiguro in The Remains of the Day, which was like this, actually, also won the Pulitzer Prize.
Hugo, let's talk a little more about Lyman Ward, this unreliable narrator. His name is curious, Lyman Ward. Lyman, particularly. He's a man who lies.
Yes. I think all of the names are significant. And as you say, Lyman, it's an unusual name. Why pick it? I think that Stegner is telling the reader implicitly that this may be a lie man, a guy who tells lies, and who is covering up the truth because of the points that I was making before about not wanting to be too revealing about his grandmother. He's loyal to his grandmother, and he doesn't want to betray his grandfather either. So his name is important. The other names are important too. I think that the name Frank Sargent for the young lover, I mean, Frank and Sargent conjures up this candid military sort of fellow. This is this young, dashing fellow. Oliver Ward, the name Ward means a sort of guard, a kind of like a warder. And, you know, to some extent, Oliver Ward has his wife, Susan, imprisoned in their marriage. Susan Burlingwood, her surname is Burling, which reminds one of the burls in wood or in wool, which are in fact floors, but they are are floors that can make the wood or the wool beautiful. So each of these names seems redolent of a quality in the characters. And, you know, Lyman Ward is in a wheelchair, as I said. He has this horrible ossifying disease, and he can't turn his head to left or right. He can only see what he turns his wheelchair to see. And that is a metaphor, I believe, for the fact that he will not see about his grandparents and about their relationship and the betrayal within their marriage what he doesn't want to look at. Unless he turns directly to face something, he doesn't see it, and he doesn't turn directly to the possibility that Frank Sargent and Susan Ward actually consummated their yearning for each other. And there is a cataclysmic event late in the book where the youngest child of the Wards, the youngest of three, a daughter who is, I think, at the age of five at that time, drowns in an irrigation ditch built by her father. And it may be, it certainly is because Susan Ward and Frank Sargent are together at that time and not paying sufficient attention, but it's presented in this ambiguous way. And although Lyman Ward concludes that Frank and Susan never consummated their love, you are led to believe that that is a distinct possibility, because not only does this cataclysmic event take place, but within a month or two thereafter, you read a news report for a month or two thereafter in which it is reported that Frank Sargent kills himself. And so he you know, associated his relationship with Susan Ward with the death of their daughter and the shame that he feels from that. And you also know that Oliver Ward connects the two things. There's an extraordinary scene late in the book where Oliver Ward, who's this stubborn, somewhat hard, not very subtle man, is out in their garden in Idaho while Susan Ward watches and another child is there weeping, and he methodically pulls up all the roses that she has planted. And it's a form of punishment and a sort of, it's a kind of recognition, and she stands and watches and takes it. And there is something about, and then there's another 50 years of their marriage when Oliver dies 50 years later and she dies within a couple of months. So they are united in their marriage, but it's a troubled bond, and there is a constant sense of guilt and things left unsaid.
This book blends fact and fiction on several different levels. We have Lyman Ward, this historian who is supposed to seek the truth about the past, you would think, but then, as we learn, he is maybe not as interested in the truth or concerned about reporting the full truth. And then you have Wallace Stegner writing this story, which is a work of fiction. It's a novel, but bringing real history into it. There's a character, John Wesley Powell, who's a real person from history. He explored the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon. And, of course, his fictional characters are operating within the real history of the United States. What do you think Stegner is trying to do with all this blending of fact and fiction?
He obviously wants to write a novel, and he does so with great skill and produces something wonderful. But he also wants to evoke a time in America. As you say, you know, there are these characters who are actually exploring, and they're on the frontier. They are developing America into the United States. He wants to reveal that time. He wants to reveal the relationship between the East Coast and the West Coast, the snobbery of the old East Coast with the toward the pragmatic and perhaps somewhat vulgar, certainly wealth-obsessed people, developers of the West. he wants to evoke the country, and he also wants to reveal the contrast between that epoch, which, I mean, as an Englishman, I would naturally call Victorian, where there was this very proper, buttoned-up, highly energetic period in American history where, you know, the Western territories were becoming states, and indeed they do in this book. And the epoch in which he is writing, which is the late 60s and 70s, where, you know, he sees hippies, they're sort of letting it all hang out. The young woman who is his housekeeper's daughter, she's obviously burned her bra. You know, she wonders why he's so hung up about sex. She obviously believes that Susan and Frank consummate their love for each other. And all of that, of course, is wrapped up in the fact that the narrator, Lyman Ward, has been abandoned by his cheating wife. And so he's revealing two distinct epochs, but he's looking at one through the lens of the other.
And what is he saying about America in these different periods? Does he prefer one to the other, or see the strengths and weaknesses of one compared to the other?
You get the impression most of the time, this being a man, a fairly elderly man in his wheelchair, that he prefers the former epoch. He admires it. He clearly admires the industry and the propriety of the 1870s and many other characteristics of it as well. And he finds the America of the 60s and 70s sort of grating, and, you know, he expresses contempt for them. But at the same time, because he is obviously a thoughtful and intelligent man, he's looking back on what is actually a failure, which is his grandparents' marriage. And he is looking back on the stubborn refusal through the last 50 years of that marriage of Oliver Ward to forgive his wife. And there he is in his wheelchair as the narrator, wondering about his own wife and wondering whether he will ever forgive her. And so there is a parallel there, and the parallel is, it's interesting, the book ends with Lyman Ward wondering whether he will be a better man than his grandfather by forgiving and taking his wife back, even though the generation, they never separated, but there isn't forgiveness.
The final line is intriguing, and I'll read it. It says, I lie wondering. There's that word lie again, isn't there? I lie wondering if I am man enough to be a bigger man than my grandfather. And then right before it, there's another line where Wallace Stegner writes in the novel, he writes, wisdom is knowing what you have to accept, unquote.
Right.
What are we left with at the end of Angle of Repose?
Well, we're left with a couple of things. One, as you say, and we've just mentioned, that he's wondering if he can be a bigger-hearted, bigger-souled, bigger person than his grandfather by taking back his wife. He has heard that his wife is, you know, no longer with the man she left her husband for, that she's not in a particularly good way. And there is a sort of dream sequence near the end of the book where Lyman Ward actually dreams of his wife being on his side and kind of rescuing him from the ministrations of this young hippie woman. So he is wondering whether he can do that. Fundamental to the book is this line that Lyman concludes with, saying he is about knowing what you have to accept. Throughout the book, we have wondered what we should accept. We have wondered what is true and what is false. Oliver Ward has not been able to accept his wife fully. Lyman Ward, at the end, wonders whether he has to accept his wife back. And so the whole, the book, actually, the conclusion of the book that one comes to is is that you have to, that it's necessary to have a quality of mercy and forgiveness, because the book itself, through the narration, is an evocation of the fact that you cannot know everything that goes into, that affects the course of your life. You simply are not in possession of all the facts, and therefore you cannot properly judge, and that you need to have a sort of quality of forgiveness and acceptance. It's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be the way that you planned it or wanted it. It's always going to be a variation of that, perhaps a wide variation of that. And the book, the whole book, as I say, is a kind of an evocation of that difficulty of having a synoptic view of your own life. And so at the end, he's concluding that you have to adjust to that human fact.
The title, Angle of Repose, is an engineering term. It describes the way sand rests in a heap, probably a term that Oliver Ward would know.
Right.
Why is that the title of this book? I'm thinking, you know, metaphor alert, right?
Yeah, metaphorically, it's about the way that people, that human beings, settle into a sort of a precarious stasis. As you say, angle repose is this engineering term. You pour sand or sugar or dirt or different things, they will form a heap at a different angle. That's the angle of repose at which they become steady. But even that is not absolutely fixed. The book is about the way characters interact with each other and how they come to a sort of form of settlement. And so it's that, I think, is the reason for the title, and it absolutely captures the engineering element that's in the book, but also the fact that these are volatile characters that have to settle with each other.
How did you discover this book? How did you first read Wallace Stegner and Angle of Repose?
My wife, who is a book reviewer, and a friend of hers were both reading it at the same time, and they did not know Stegner, and just said how beautifully written it was, and so I decided to take it up. And I've, of course, read a little bit more about it since then, but one of the things that I really enjoyed about doing this was that I read the book without having read anything about it. And so all the impressions and pretty much all of the things that I'm saying to you and have said to you today are simply the impressions of, you know, of a first-time reader.
You're a busy journalist in Washington, D.C. You're the editor-in-chief of the Washington Examiner. Why do you make time for trivialities like novels?
They aren't trivial. I think it's extremely important for... you know, I mentioned early on that one of the characteristics of great art, great books, is that they say something that is important, and I don't mean that it's important to your day-to-day life. It's important to your kind of development, I think, fully as a person, as a human being. That's what all art does. It gives you, it adds something to your life. And so we, even at the, you know, at the Washington Examiner, we're mostly, we write about politics, but we have a weekly magazine, and it has a life and art section at the back, and we think that makes for a more complete publication. And every couple of twice a year we have a winter book section and we have a summer book section. And one of the things that we do is the editors pick books that are good to reread. And it strikes me that although this was my first reading of Angle of Repose, it's now been out. It was written in 1971, published in 1971, and won the Pulitzer Prize in 1972. So it's exactly 50 years since it won the prize. I think it's a good book for anybody who has not read it to read it, but I also think it's a good book for anyone who read it when it first came out to reread it.
And final question, why is it a book for today? You just mentioned it was published in 1971. A lot of it takes place in the 19th century. It's concerned with the 1960s. Wallace Stegner died in 1993. What can Angle of Repose say to us in the 2020s?
Well, I think that it has a universal lesson rather than a temporal one. Well, this is the temporal one and the universal one. You know, we live in an extraordinary and baneful culture in which we think we should judge everything by the standards that we pretend that we have agreed on now. and we cancel people who say things that or are found 10 years ago to have said things which don't accord with our current mores. And this is a book about the lens of time and the passage of history and the different way that people behaved and the different things that they thought. And it's about forgiveness for those different perspectives. And so Angle of Repose, like most really fine works of creativity, have something which is sort of beyond time. But the interesting thing about this is that it's also about the passage of time and about our attitude towards different epochs and people who lived in essentially different civilizations.
Hugo Gurdon, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner.
Great to be with you, John. I enjoyed it.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.